Good evening. My name is Marissa Levine, and I'm the director of InForum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. And I'm really, really excited to welcome you here tonight. I can't lie about that. To spend the night with Alan Cumming. And to also spend the night with Cleve Jones. If for any reason you're unfamiliar with them, Alan is an actor, activist, and author. His latest book, You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams, is right here if you don't have a copy yet. And Cleve Jones, founder of the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt, human rights activist, and author, is here to moderate him this evening. Let's give it up. Now, maybe you made a friend on your way in, or maybe you came with a friend, but if you're not aware, Alan is notorious for his club coming after parties where new and old friends of his mingle. In that spirit, take 5 seconds, no long friendships here, to turn to the person next to you and shake hands and say hello. And that's exactly enough friendship. No more. You can make friends more on the book line. Now, if you're new to InForum or to the Commonwealth Club, you may not know that tonight is one of more than 400 programs we put on annually. Our home right now is at 555 Post, so we're on a little field trip to the Castro tonight. But we are moving to a brand new home that we own at 110 The Embarcadero in 2017. So if you like, you know, rooftop parties with views of the Bay Bridge, you should think about joining us as a volunteer, member, donor, supporter, come to more events, what have you. Now, coming up this fall, just a sneak preview, on October 10th, we have Sophia Amoroso, founder of Nasty Gal. October 12th, Lovey Ajayi, tech and culture speaker. October 28th, the comedian Joel McHale. Now, if you didn't know, we're having an election this year. So we're doing a whole bunch of election-related coverage, including a program on October 20th with Congressman Eric Swalwell, a series of almost sold-out debate parties, get into the last one on the 19th while you can, and ballots and bruise parties to help interpret that 300-page ballot document you're going to be getting in the mail. So there are also free tickets to a program with famed author Tracy Kidder available, so pick up a coupon in the lobby on your way out. Now tonight, we are not going to tell you to put your cell phones away, but please turn the ringers off. We are avid live tweeters. If you don't know, Alan's a little active on Twitter. Cleve is as well. So you'll see their Twitter handles up behind you. Feel free to follow them, follow us, tweet along, take pictures. Just don't bother your neighbors with your ringers, please. We'll be doing live questions in the last 15 minutes of the program. If you know what questions are, they're about 20 words long, no personal stories, and they end with a question mark. So keep them like that. Thank you. There's going to be at least three of you that forget that. So keep them short. The book signing will take place afterwards. We encourage you to line up along the left. Alan will sign all books. No personal photos. The rules will be on the screen when they're done. We'll have Facebook photos up from the signing tomorrow, though. And now, without any further ado, thank you for your patience. It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers to the InForum stage, the inimitable Alan Cumming and Cleve Jones.
Oh, my God, Cleve.
Well, thank you all for coming. Welcome to the Castro Theater and my neighborhood. We have a lot to talk about, and I want to thank again the Commonwealth Club for putting this together. This is one of my favorite places in the entire world, this building. It holds a lot of history for me and many of you, I'm sure, as well. Our guest is an amazing man with
Can you talk about a bar?
Why don't you do the honors?
Would you like a...
They already poured one for me, actually.
I think that's taste that, because that's not what I asked for.
Oh, that works for me.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Cheers.
Cheers. No.
No?
I'll make myself one, don't worry.
Yeah, sorry. So we have an amazing actor, a man who's had an extraordinary life. He's also a singer and a writer and a very articulate and passionate advocate for many causes ranging from LGBT equality to Scottish independence.
And
yes. And I frankly know very little about Hollywood or Broadway, so we're going to talk
like
some politics. And, yeah, careful. Are you ready?
Please, shoot.
Well, actually, it is also the beginning of Folsom Street Fair weekend. And as he's getting his drink ready, I have to tell you, this book he's written is really quite marvelous. It's full of photographs. He apparently originated selfies, who knew, back in the day. And each one of them is sort of a window to a moment in his life with some of the most extraordinary people. And a few of them I've shared some experiences with. I've been to Carrie Fisher's house for a party, and I have a great, I had a great encounter with Elizabeth Taylor,
so
and
I love
those stories.
About.
But I think, in honor of the Folsom Street Fair,
yeah,
that you should read Fleshbot.
Okay.
You want to hear him read something?
I've never read this in public before, so do bear with me. Fleshbot. If you're reading this with me, it's page 128. You ready? In 2011, Fleshbot, the sex blog, decided to give me their Sex Fashion Award. For, I suppose, my sexy fashion choices, but also for my sex positivity, particularly in the campaign for my fragrance line, Coming. Yes. I had a fragrance, and it was called Coming. And I was shot recreating various iconic fragrance advertisements of the past, and I got naked for the commercial and lolled around in a bed with eyeliner on and talked about shame not being sexy. If you really want to know, I also had a body lotion called Coming All Over. A body scrub called Coming Off Buff. And a body wash called Coming Clean. But my particular favorite was the soap, Coming in a Bar. Thank you. I actually have a second fragrance that is still available, and it's called, can you guess? Second Coming, yes. Ruined my gag. Now, I love an award show at the best of times, but one that celebrates sexuality and sex positivity is even more up my alley. The first thing that delighted me on arrival at the Fleshbot Awards was the goodie bag. First of all, it was waiting for you on your chair. You didn't have to do that embarrassing thing. Oops, excuse me. It's so new and sprightly, this book. I can hardly get my fingers through it. That embarrassing walk by twinkie interns clutching handfuls of them as you left the event and silently exhort them to hand one over, it was already there. And in it, there was a fleshlight. For those of you not in the know, like my mother-in-law this evening, I imagine. Randy, this is for you. A fleshlight is a masturbation device. It's that black thing on the left of the picture. Oops. It's more complicated than I thought. Black thing, there's a picture. You unscrew the lid at the bottom of it and you discover a latex interpretation of a vagina, an anus, or indeed, as my extensive research for writing this story has uncovered. Oh, I wish I hadn't mentioned my mother-in-law now. A mouth. Mine, though, the one that I got, was a beautiful pink vagina. You then lube up. I can't believe you made me read this. You then lube up and insert your penis into the fleshlight, and you experience a very lifelike, some say even better than lifelike, but I think they need to get out more. Recreation of what it feels like to be penetrating another human. You then pull the fleshlight up and down, and well, I'm sure you get it. I'd wanted a fleshlight forever, and now here it was, free in a goodie bag. I think it rated as my top award show swag ever. Perhaps equal with an orthopedic bed I once got from the Emmys. And as you can see from the picture, they also very kindly included some condoms and lube, and that gleaming silver dildo is the actual award. So, like, maybe you can't see, but here's the fleshlight, here's some condoms, some lube, and this thing here is the actual award I got. Please don't clap. For many reasons, this was a night of firsts. I'd never been at an award show that ended with some of the presenters showing their genitalia before. Well, not in public, at least. I'd never seen my name engraved on a dildo before. I had never received an award that I could potentially penetrate myself with. Safely, at least. Oh, my God. I'm so, so sorry, Randy. many years ago, when I lived in London, my friend Richard introduced me to a game called Nobbing the Bronze. It was a very English public schoolboy repressed sexuality sort of a wheeze, but nonetheless quite fun. What happened was, if you won an award, the bronze, you had to, as soon as was decently possible, hit it with your penis. The nobbing of the bronze. That was basically it. I remember once wearing a kilt when I won a big theatre award and was able to nob my bronze before I even got back to my seat. But then, as the evening wore on and drinks were imbibed, the game became more daring. You had to go and ask various famous people if they would nob your bronze too. And you'd be surprised how many acquiesced. The thing about having a sex toy as your bronze, to begin with, though, is that there's no need to nob it. It is inherently already knobbed. My fleshbot has pride of place among my award stash, and it gets handled by the curious way more than any of the others. I forgot how dirty that was. I just have to say that I think we need another glass. Because this is not could someone bring in another glass?
Bartender.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
And please, it's my pleasure. My mother-in-law is in my pleasure.
I look forward to meeting her after this so we can talk.
Me too.
Now, I read that in your book that you were not pleased with Terry Gross's line of questioning, so I'm not going to inquire about your sexuality or your armpit hair. Is there anything more you want to say about that, though?
Yes, it's not that she was interested in. I mean, I think my sexuality and my armpit hair are two areas that are worthy of discussion, but I just think when it becomes overly discussed in an interview about this supposed to be at something else, it seems like it becomes kind of what's the word? Prurient and just kind of sensational. Thank you so much. And which one's that?
It's not one of mine.
And much as I love Terry Gross. I do. I mean, it's interesting when you meet, you know, Terry Gross. Obviously, we all listen to her and we think she's a sage and a. Let's hear it for Terry Gross. So imagine if, like, you were being interviewed by Terry Gross, who you listen to as this clever, penetrative sage of a woman who you really agree with on many things and you like her line of questioning. Then she starts talking to you and she goes on and on and on and on and on about your sexuality and your armpit hair until the point you have to go, you're really embarrassed and you have to go, stop it, Terry. It kind of, it was disappointing to me.
Mm-hmm. I understand. So I hate to spoil the mood, but there's some serious shit going on, and you, I've lived here a long time now, but I hear people talking about the vote in the UK, the Brexit vote, as a, some sort of foreshadowing of what's happening here. And also, I know you've been a campaigner.
Oh, sorry. That's how excited I am to be with you, Clee.
It's really lovely to see you again. You've campaigned for Scottish independence, so let's talk about Trump, talk about what's going to happen with Scotland now. Is this going to open the door for Scottish independence again? Do you think there'll be another round, another vote?
Well, can I sort of talk about the refugee thing first of all and make it kind of a note more holistic?
65 million people living in refugee camps today, more than any time in history.
Did you know that 65 million people in the world living in refugee camps? And why I asked if I could talk about this, because I feel like my feelings about Brexit, Scottish independence, Trump, everything is overshadowed by this idea, or not an idea, this fact that right now in the world there's been great displacement of people. I mean, there always is. And I recently went to Lebanon with the UN, the UNHCR. Thanks. Don't clap for that. Oh, I'll do if you want, but don't, you know, actually make donations rather than clap. So the UNHCR is the UN High Commission on Refugees. And it was an organization that was formed after the Second World War in order to help the displacement of people who were, you know, displaced after all the terrible things that happened. And it was only designed to be a thing that would only last a few years. Oh, here we are, you know, 60, whatever, 70 years later. It's now, only about 20 years ago was it designated a permanent thing. So I went to the UN, I went to Lebanon with the UN because, partly because I feel I have a voice and I can do good things in the world if that I think are good because of my fame, but also because so much of the, I had seen so many things happen in the rest of the world that I felt were due to this displacement of people. And when that happens, when people come into other people's cultures, they get scared and terrified and they start to have more extreme views. So, for example, a big thing about Brexit and the vote for Britain to leave the EU was to do with this mass of refugees coming from Syria and Iraq and other countries and going to Turkey, and then in Turkey they got on all these boats, and so many, like, thousands and thousands of people have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea trying to get away from the war in Syria, and some of them, they've arrived and they've gone to different countries. But it's been a huge social and political issue in Europe, and it really, really affected the Brexit vote, because I think that what happened was the language of fear was used so much about the idea of the other, the idea that these people are coming into our country, we're not doing that well ourselves, but now all these foreigners are coming. And within Europe there's a big thing about asylum seekers, and who already before the war in Syria were coming in, and there's a lot of unrest about, especially in the south of England, who received most of these people. So this idea was then enhanced by this wave of immigrants, or not immigrants, but refugees coming into the country. And whenever there's unrest and change in any country, perhaps like a new election about to happen, it's very easy for people to use the language of fear to make the people who potentially are going to vote have quite radical opinions. Even if their economic situation is quite good, even if things are going quite well, even if they have jobs, but it's easy to use a language of fear to change people's opinions and make them do quite radical things. And so, in a way, what I'm trying to say is that the language of fear that was used in Brexit is now being used, not just was already being used, right now in the American election system. And this idea of the other, these immigrants who are coming in, these rapists and murderers, these Muslims who are coming in. And it was so fascinating for me to go to Lebanon and see these people who had really been displaced, who were the, you know, ground zero, if you like. These people who had been displaced, had tried to live in their country, had had to go to another country for salvation, and were living in these huts, like, you know, two chairs like this would have been their home. It was really, and a piece of tarpaulin over the top. It really was galling. And all these people wanted to do was go back to their homes. They didn't want anything from us. They didn't want to harm us. They didn't. Refugees are refugees for a reason. They're not kind of, you know, operatives trying to infiltrate us. They're people who have been displaced by great violence and persecution. And for me, I think Brexit and the rise of Trump are an example of the way that rhetoric about the other and about people who are different from you and people who may share different religions from you and people you don't understand can suddenly be whipped into a language of absolute fear and absolute fascism. And I really, really, really fear that's happening in this country right now.
I'm terrified. I posted the other day on Facebook that I had a young person tell me that, oh, all elections are like this.
No, they're not.
And then I had a person my age, I'll be 62 next in a couple of weeks, who said, well, you know, we survived Nixon and we survived Reagan. And the first thing I thought was of all my friends, and your friends I'm sure as well, who did not survive Reagan, I thought of all of the people in Cambodia and Vietnam and Laos who did not survive Nixon. And there was such a sort of cavalier attitude about it. But this is unlike anything we've seen in a long time. And I find it very frightening.
I do too. And I think it's interesting as well because I think, you know, for Republican voters, and I'm sure there are some here this evening. I know there are some here this evening.
Oh.
You know, who I totally respect. I don't respect the American political system because, like in any other democracy, most of the there's not just two parties. It's not a binary thing. Yeah. It's amazing that America has taken however many hundreds of years you are, not that many, but the idea that you still only have two political parties that are, you know, I know there's the Green, the Independent, but seriously though, mostly every democracy eventually breaks down into a more accurate depiction of the society's views. And America's stayed in this way, I think on purpose, because it stops people becoming political, because basically politics is like this. It's a two-way thing. It's like some sort of, you know, every once in a while, every 4 years, you have to make a choice. Instead of being active and it being a part of how it affects your life. So I'm just so sorry, I just have 45. That's 45 minutes to go. I know, it's really interesting. But what was I saying? Something about... Oh, yes, I know. But what I think was interesting right now is that for people who are Republican, they're now being asked to vote for someone who is absolutely nothing like their ideals. He's kind of like this Which is also, I think, how, like, you know, the people in Germany in the 30s were us, and the people in Italy and in South America, when fascist leaders come to power, of course, they come to power slowly, and people look away and they kind of laugh, and then they start to panic, and then all of a sudden you have this fascist regime. I do really feel for Republicans right now who have to make this choice about whether they're going to vote for Donald Trump or not. He is their leader. He is their candidate. But actually, what I think is the most important thing, and really the thing if you take anything away from this evening, I would like you to consider this point, that America does not value education enough.
Well put on.
And so the reason Donald Trump is so popular is that we all have to take responsibility for this, have created a generation, a society where people do not analyze, people probably don't vote sometimes, but maybe they're being engendered to vote now by this rhetoric he's spouting, but they don't question things. If they're told the same thing enough times, they will think it's true. The media, we've created a media, a non-educated media, which doesn't only reports, it does not take these people to task, it does not question, it does not fact check, it's infotainment has become, we used to joke about that, now that is the order of the day. So we live in this age of if you're white and not just white, but if you're rich, if you have money in this country, then you have, you know, education and you have healthcare and you have justice. If you're not wealthy in this country, you are not guaranteed health or education or justice. That's just the fact. So the idea, what's really terrifying is the idea that someone, because we've created this uneducated culture, sadly, this country might be ruled by someone who's going to even more punish people and not make them educated or healthy or have justice. And that's the biggest flaw, because actually any culture that's going to survive needs to have people who are educated and healthy and have justice at the very core of their society. So I'm really worried about the rise of Donald Trump. And I would just say that if there are some Republicans in this room who are fighting and are having a moral dilemma about the idea of voting for someone they see as an extremist, even though he represents a party they have thought could do well for this country and has done well for this country in certain times, then I think you have a duty to not vote for him, to say don't vote, and also to go out, and I don't normally adhere to the idea of not voting. Vote for all your senators and congressmen, do all that, but do not vote for this man. He's a dangerous, dangerous man. And also, please go out. If you have any worries, don't toe the party line. Go out and talk to as many of your friends who might be wavering and try and tell them that it's a dangerous thing for America that Donald Trump becomes president of this country. That's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
And for those of you who want to really take part in stopping this nightmare from happening, I work for Unite here. In this town, we're local too, the Hotel Workers Union, and we've taken responsibility for delivering the northern part of Nevada, which is emerging as a key state in the presidential race, and also the race to fill Harry Reid's seat. He's retiring. So the balance of the Senate as well as the presidential race might be decided right next door. You can find me on Facebook, and I'll send you up there and put you in a hotel room and have you canvass precincts if you'd like to do that, and I would encourage you to do
so. Good deal.
So one of our great writers who has written a lot about politics is someone you write about in this book, someone I've had a number of encounters with over the decades, and that was Gore Vidal. And every time I encountered him, I left that encounter with a dark feeling in my stomach, and I wanted you to talk a little bit because I was quite struck by what you wrote about Mr. Vidal.
Well, I mean, he is a Gore Vidal was a brilliant person. He was sparkling and witty, and, you know, if he were on the stage tonight, he'd be doing much better than us, I imagine. But his wit and his lashingness, ultimately, I knew him over a few years, and I wrote a story in my book. I write a story about when I went to visit him in his house in Italy, and I just found him. And I was the photo. The photo that this story inspires is a photo that I took of the running order of the of his funeral. It's a memorial service, which I was, you know, imagine. I was very honored. I was asked to speak at his memorial. I mean. It's kind of amazing. I can't believe that actually happened to me. But I write this story. I'd written this story before, and then I kind of bookended it a bit because of this book and the idea of it having a connection to photographs. And I just felt there was no joy in him. He was kind of a mean person. And there was two things about him. I write in his book a lot about, in my book, a lot about the idea that he could sit there with his partner 50 years, like 50 years, sitting next to him and saying, "No, Alan, I have never loved." And imagine, you know, and then for him to say that he, there was an interesting conundrum for me because he was talking about this idea that there is in America about sexual relations, what that means and all this stuff, and about how President Clinton was able to say, "I've never had sexual relations with that woman," referring to Monica Lewinsky, who is a very dear friend of mine and was even when I met Gore. And he was saying, "I understand what he means because sexual relations does not cover any of the interactions that President Clinton had with Monica." And I found that so difficult to cope with as well. I mean, I do find, sorry to say this, but American people seem to, and even still, even young people, like you say, "Oh, we didn't have sex, we just fooled around." And that to me, fooled around means like, you know, rolled some dice. Had a game of Scrabble. Maybe play dress up, but it does not involve putting a penis in your mouth. And that was a weird noise. So I found him very challenging, even though as much as I admired him and I liked him very, it was sparkling to be in his company. I found him mean and unforgiving and
joyless.
Yeah. Cleve, yeah.
Well, let's get away from that then and talk about someone wonderful. I loved your Elizabeth. You all right over there? What is that? I love the story about Elizabeth Taylor, and I have my own wonderful Elizabeth Taylor story because she was so great with AIDS from the beginning. And, you know, she was friends with Reagan and all of those Republican fools, and she lost all those friends because she stood with us. And she stood with us in a very real way and used her power to lobby
and
Congress.
And didn't she manage to sort of get Reagan to talk about AIDS for the first time because she lured him to this awards ceremony?
Yes.
Her and Dr. Krim?
Yes, I was there.
You were?
It was really intense, and he was booed. And I said, "I'm sorry that, you know, I hope you didn't feel awkward." No, she said, "No, he needed to hear it. He needed to hear it." But she came to the quilt display, the final display of the quilt, and we covered the entire mall. And we set up a trailer for her behind the Lincoln Memorial from where she would address the crowd. And she had the hottest security guy I've ever seen in my life. Oh, my gosh. And I kept walking by the trailer, you know. And he thought I was trying to talk to her. And then at one point I walk by and I hear her yelling inside. She was upset. And I said, what's wrong with Miss Taylor? And he said, well, she's very frightened of speaking in public, which I thought was so odd, you know. And I said, well, let me talk to her. I've given speeches here many times, and I can calm her down. And so he knocked on the door, and I went in, and those eyes.
Violet eyes.
I mean, really, violet eyes.
They're like purple. You can't believe, people say violet eyes. Like, when you see them, like, what? Like an alien. Yeah.
And she was very upset, and I said, what's wrong? And she said, I hate public speaking. And I said, look, it doesn't matter what you say, because everyone there already loves you. And you could go up there and recite the alphabet, and people would just continue to love you for what you've done for us, and everybody knows it, and everyone knows you were the first. And she said, really, really? And I said, yeah, calm down, relax. And then as I was leaving, I remembered that we're right next, you know, it's right next to, I won't call it by its current name, National Airport in Washington, D.C., and that if you do anything on the mall before 10 p.m., there's a very strong likelihood that a jet's going to go right over you in mid-speech. So I informed her of this, and she got very nervous and said, oh, no, what, a jet's going to go over? They won't be able to hear me. I said, look, it's simple. When you hear the sound of the aircraft, just pause, look up, look at your watch, tap your toe, look up again, and then everyone will know you're waiting for the jet to go by. And sure enough, halfway through her speech, the jet came over. She stopped, she looked up, she looked at her wrist, tapped her foot. And when I told Gus that, he said, oh, girl, you directed Elizabeth Taylor.
You did? That's fantastic.
But she was amazing.
She's so cute, yeah.
So amazing. I also liked your description of Liza. She was also really good with us in the early days of the quilt. And when I met her, my first thought was, I want to take care of you. I wanted to get her a blanket or something. You know.
I just saw Liza yesterday, actually.
Really?
Yeah. I've just come from L.A., and she's living in L.A. now. And she's such a darling. Like, I write in my book about her. But I feel... In a funny way, you know, it's so weird. Like, I get how, you know, we're both showbiz, Broadway, la la la. But actually, from where I'm from and how I feel about my life, the idea that I'm friends with Liza is so nuts. But actually, I feel that we have a very similar sensibility and kind of, you know... outlook on the world. And yesterday I was in her apartment and she was watching Fox News. Fox Business News, actually. And she was saying, like, she said to me things like, I'm terrified. I was like, well, you're watching Fox News. What do you expect? And and she said, like, I want to buy a chalet in Switzerland. I was like, why? And she goes, because it's neutral. And I was like, all right, I'm in. And then I said to her, don't watch Fox News, Liza. It's all just like this rhetoric of fear. It's all about fear, you know. Yes, we should be wary, we should be vigilant, but you can't live your life being fearful of everything. You can't. Otherwise, you just, like, crawl into a hole. So you've got to, like, go out into the world with quite an open heart and expect that some people will engage with you in that same spirit. I said, why don't you watch CNN? And she was like, okay. So I put CNN on, and then I went to the loo and I came back. She put it back to Fox. The familiar, I suppose, you know.
When did you first visit San Francisco?
I know, I came first to San Francisco in 1996.
Notice any changes?
Well, actually, not really, because I was saying to you earlier when we came down the stairs, I've come here many, many, many times over the years, and I, you know, also my husband is from here, from the Bay Area, and so it's here for him, yeah, yeah. So I come a lot, and I go and stay with my mum-in-law. in Piedmont, and Piedmont power. So I have this kind of, but I come in short bursts. I've never really spent a sustained amount of time here, so I'm always kind of learning, and especially in the city, I'm always kind of, you know, learning about it. So I know there must have been huge changes since then. But in 1996, I actually, a friend of mine was directing a film here, and I came with my then fiance, who was a lady. That's how long ago it was, and we stayed on a B&B in one of those boats by the, you know, in the harbour, and there's
Sausalito?
No, in here in San Francisco, like one of the jetties. What do you call it? You know, you can rent
piers. What?
Piers, yeah, one of the piers, yeah. It was pretty exciting.
I think you should buy a place here, but I would suggest that you not get one in the Millennium Tower. it's crumbling. They built this silver tower for the rich people, and fortunately it's sinking into the mud.
I would never want to go there.
I posted on Facebook, and some people wanted me to ask you about bisexuals and visibility of bisexual people in the movement. And that's something I read about frequently, people asking about that. So what do you want to say anything about that?
I feel, you know, that there's so many great things about living now when we do, and living in an age when I can say my husband and nobody bats an eye and nobody boos me or throws eggs at me or wants to kill me. I mean, maybe some people do. But at the same time, I think when the more kind of advances are made in terms of opening up people to different ideas, there's also a closing off in some ways too. And I think, like, I do feel like I'm bisexual. I have a husband, you know, but I used to be married to a woman, and a couple of them actually, and are nearly, you know, like, but you know, my exes are, you know, of different sexes, and I've never thought I wasn't a bisexual. I understand that the pendulum has swung and blah blah blah. But I've just, for me, I refuse to close off the possibility of even my mind, not in real life, mother-in-law, to the idea of you know, this is what I like, and this is what. So, and I think it's interesting because people say, "Well, you're with a man now. Why don't you consider yourself gay?" And I say, well, if you had no sex for like 6 months, would you consider yourself not straight? Thank you. And so this thing about what defines you as your sexuality or your gender or whatever you want to be called, isn't that about you should decide it rather than the people outside of you? And so, and I've really noticed this trend to be. I mean, I get it. I think when you're gay, or of any minority actually, when you are free to be who you want to be with other people like you. I get that. I really understand that. But that means you kind of wear a uniform and you only just do the things that this group has decided you do. It means you wear a certain clothes and you look, your hair is a certain way. But if you, in a funny way, you close yourself off to the idea of other things. And I've never done that. I've never wanted to do that. And so sometimes I feel the biggest things that I'm an activist for are because of things that I feel I'm being asked to stop by society.
I'm about 11 years older than you. So when When AIDS began, I was in my late 20s. So I think your generation, during the time when you were discovering your own sexuality and figuring out what that meant to you, was right when that nightmare was beginning. How did that impact you as a young man?
You know, Cleve, it's actually the only thing that I could ever thank Margaret Thatcher for. And I mean, because I think she was a truly heinous person. I mean, and I'm not even saying that, not even take away the political things, take away the economic things, just as a moral person, she did some things that, and perhaps you won't even understand it if you have never lived in Britain at that time, but trust me on this. She was not a good woman. But the only thing that I will ever consider giving her a positive vibe about is, and probably she didn't even have anything to do with this, but she condoned it, which is the sex education campaign that her government put out in the early 80s when AIDS first happened. And it was this big thing. It's a very famous, iconic sort of advertising. It was an iceberg which said AIDS on it. So the whole notion was it's much, much, much more than you'll ever begin to fear, you know, this idea of an iceberg. And that was like when I was 16, 17, when I was becoming sexually active. So my entire life was, and my conditioning about safe sex was, I'm loath to say, a credit to Margaret Thatcher.
Mm. I'm not sure that's really the response I was looking for.
But I've become, you know, as you get older and, but you know, when early days, of course, I knew people who were dying and I once did a show. I remember very vividly doing a show in Glasgow in the late 80s. There was a benefit for a thing called Crusade. It was an AIDS charity. And I saw someone in the front row in a wheelchair, obviously very sick, who I'd had sex with. And it was the first moment I was like, what? You know? And I'm very, very lucky. I lived through that time. I thought I was always being safe, and I tried, you know, I think we've all got responsibilities. But I just hit it at the right moment that with fear, not the good fear. I mean, this is the good fear to try and make you not have AIDS, not the bad fear that Donald Trump is trying to make you worry about everyone who does not look like you. But I do feel I was someone who hit that time at the most optimum time, was able to have a great life, but also very aware of your responsibilities and your safety in sexuality.
I think here it created a strange sort of generation gap that the younger people who were coming of age at the height of it were just so horrified by it. And I think a friend of mine, Sean Stroob, was in town about a year ago to do a book reading about ACT UP and his involvement in that. And I was struck by who was there at the reading. 80% of them were 50 or over. There was no one in their 40s or 30s. And then there were a smattering of young people in their 20s for whom it was a lesson in some kind of history that they were trying to learn more about. But I think it's affected us in ways that we're just now maybe beginning to understand.
I just made a film that is hopefully going to come out next year called After Louis, and it's really about this schism between the generations of older of gay men, and there's an older gay man, sadly played by me, and
get over it.
I know. Imagine who was very involved in ACT UP as a very young man, of course, and. And now is kind of like, you know, has been an artist, and now is kind of transfixed on that time and is making a documentary about someone he knew who had died, and who then meets this much younger man, and
this younger man has... And basically there's this, you know, schism between them where the old guy's going like me, like going, you don't understand what it was like. We fought for all these things for you. You're able to do blah, blah, and blah because of us. And the young guy's going, I know, thank you, but like, I wasn't in the war. I'm never going to be able to be in the war. Don't make it boring and push me away. And I think it's such an... I never heard this... what's the word? Not argument, but this kind of... dichotomic rhetoric, if you will, before. Yet, once I'd read the script, I realized I knew so many people from both sides of the argument that really, really understood it. Mm-hmm. And so this is, I've thought more and more about this, that I think, you know, PTSD has been something that affected me very much. In my last book, I talked about my grandfather died in Malaysia playing Russian roulette, obviously very affected by PTSD. I feel I've had PTSD from my abusive father. I feel like a whole generation of not just gay men, but people who understood what was happening when AIDS was ravaging people, they're having PTSD. They've had PTSD. They're coming out of it. But PTSD is a long-term thing. And I think there's a whole swathe of our population who are just like coming to terms, like with the Vietnam issue, that people are understanding now that it goes on for many decades, that you have to deal with the problems of putting people into situations where they're so let go by their governments and so not cared for. AIDS was the same thing. And now we have we're still dealing with this schism, and now that schism is becoming apparent because the middle generation just aren't there. So that's what this film is about, and I hope...
Is it called again?
It's called After Louis, and hopefully it'll be out in film festivals and something next year.
In about 5 minutes, we're going to be taking questions for Alan, so I'm instructed to remind you to ask single, one-part questions that are actually questions with a question mark, okay? We'll be doing that in about 5 minutes. I just want to say a little bit more about what, I find myself sometimes being that old queen doing this at people, and especially around issues of sexual health. And you hear a lot of resistance, even in this town, around PrEP, the pre-exposure prophylaxis drug, Truvada, which prevents people who are HIV negative from getting the disease. And I hear so many people my own age who survived such misery and incredible loss. And they're shaming and they're blaming these kids. And I keep saying, you know, they didn't live through that. They can't possibly understand what it was. And thank God they don't understand what it was. But instead of the wagging the finger and the shaming and the blaming, let's try to tell them how beautiful they are, how much we love them, how much their lives do matter to us, and how much we want them to protect themselves.
He's such a darling.
Thank you. Well, now I'm quite thrown. You want to talk about Glenn Close's back?
yes, but could I just say a little bit about what you just said? Because I feel like I totally am with you. I totally feel like I'm a totally sex-positive person. But also I feel like there is this, and this whole new drug, and perhaps some of you don't know, but I'm sure most of you do, but about PrEP, which you can take it and you can... For like 96% or
99.9%.
That's that 0.0% I worry about. But you can have sex with impunity and not worry if someone is HIV positive. For this drug, it lets you have sex with someone who is HIV positive, and it can some way force the HIV away. I have to say, I know this sounds like a conspiracy theory. But I have to say, so now we have drugs. So first of all, I come from a country that is not this, obviously. We have free healthcare. We don't have insurance company. We have them a little bit now because your whole thing has infected us. But really, in the main, it is still possible to exist in Scotland without an insurance plan, to go, if you're sick, to go to a doctor and get free drugs and free healthcare. So, I know, crazy, right? And so, I mean, we pay about the same tax as you. So I think, what is happening? Where's the tax money going? War, thank you, yes, probably. So, but my point is that I feel worried about this idea that the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry in this country are so powerful and control so much of the rhetoric in terms of healthcare that we're able to have a drug that if you're HIV, say I was HIV positive, I could have a cocktail of drugs that would just completely make my life fine. It would take my counts down to zero. It would be undetectable. I could take a pill every day. A very damaging pill. It's not like a baby aspirin. It's a lot. It has effects on other things that we're only starting to find out. Also, now I could take a pill. Let's take this pill, not every day actually, and say I went and had sex, unprotected sex, with someone who was HIV positive, who even had full-blown AIDS, actually. And they could be inside me and ejaculate inside my body, and this drug I could take would stop me, would repel me from them from infecting me, and I would be fine. Yet we don't have the ability to have a cure for AIDS.
Well, where's the profit in the cure?
There's no profit in the cure. Yeah. And that, I feel, is like diabetes, HIV, AIDS. There's so many illnesses in this country that I think we have to look again at how we've allowed the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry to have so much power. And, of course, you know, it used to be that our medical industries were the proudest things in our cultures. They were the ones that were going to stop these illnesses and give advances and make all the... Now they're basically financial, like, money-making things. And because of that, I really do feel that there are illnesses that we are all facing, and some of us may all have to deal with till the day we die, that could be cured like that, but because it's not financially viable.
Well, I'm afraid I totally agree with you. I think, however, it's just a reality. And for me, one of the great disappointments of the 8 years of Obama was that we didn't get what we needed in terms of real healthcare reform. But for people who are dealing with HIV in their day-to-day now
life... What do you mean by that? Can I ask you about what do you mean by that? We didn't get what we wanted, but don't you think Obamacare is a huge step in that direction?
It's a very good step in certain directions. The extension of coverage for young people to 26 is huge.
But it's only affected 20 million people.
Removing the pre-existing condition.
That's
absolutely
great.
Absolutely.
And also, for anyone who's out here who thinks that we must repeal Obamacare or repeal Obamacare...
No, I'm not suggesting any such thing.
I know you're not. I wasn't talking to you. But this is a country of how many? 300 and what million people? 230 million people. So Obamacare has only made, at its apex, 20 million more people have access to the very basic health care. So all the other 310 million people, if you're grouching about that, fuck you.
Clearly, it's an improvement, but what we need is universal care.
And the
health insurance industry was so involved in writing the legislation.
Totally. And that's the thing, you know, Cleve, I'm from Scotland. We pay as much taxes as you do here in America.
And
we have free education and free health care.
You know, people with AIDS in Scotland are treated so much better than what we have.
Totally.
It's amazing. housing, for such everything they need.
I remember in the mid '80s doing things in in Scotland about with healthcare things. It's a sensibility. It's a different, because I think, like, you know, I mean, I love this country. I've become a citizen here, and I understand. I think I understand it, but I don't understand this idea that I face quite often, where people think that you don't have to look after other people, that it's not just a prerequisite of your being in this world. I think if you live in it, if you, whatever you are, like that, you know, Ubuntu, this thing, and I talk about this quite a lot, but Ubuntu is a very simple thing. It means basically, I am only happy if you're all happy. It's like having a party, you know. If I'm having a party, if there's someone at my party not happy, I'm like, oh, this is a terrible party. That's life, I think, you know. Yeah. If someone's not healthy, we're all not healthy. If someone's doing not well financially, we're all not doing well financially. And I think that, okay, anyway, it's a huge deal, of course, but that's the difference between Scotland and America.
And I think also there's this pervasive notion in this country that things only have value if they bring profit to shareholders. And it's happening with education, it's happening with the arts, it's happening with everything. Everything is being privatized. And to have that be the signature of healthcare, that you can only get it if some people profit from it, it's just, to me, fundamentally wrong. And I'm told for questions.
So questions.
There are people out there with wireless mics. So raise your hand and remember, you are asking
questions.
This
is sponsored by Pfizer.
And Gilead.
We have a question, stage right, towards the back.
Sure. So you talked about fascism today and some themes of cultural education, and you also recently closed Cabaret on Broadway for the second time. So I'm curious about your thoughts when you were closing that.
My thoughts on closing Cabaret, or that whole thing. Well, I guess I could say that the reason I did it again, and the reason I feel it's such a great show and why it has so much to say, is because it deals with certain issues about things that I think are very important and still very relevant right now. For example, even more relevant, actually, the idea of being vigilant as a society about what is happening politically and not turning away when things that you don't like or you don't feel are appropriate are being voiced. And also the idea, also embracing the idea of difference and the other, and that someone comes from somewhere else or some other part of culture from you and you don't understand that, your first reaction should not be to look away and to, like, think they're bad. Your first reaction should be to say, tell me about yourself. So that's why I did that play so many times, and sadly that's why I feel that play keeps being done, because it is so relevant to our times. I think we live in a culture where I've spoken about this a lot tonight, but this rhetoric of the other and our fear of the other and this idea that we should fear something that is different from us rather than think, gosh, what an interesting idea. That's what's important. And that's why I did it, and that's why I'm glad I did it, and that's why. And maybe I'll do it again in 16 years' time. I'll play Fräulein Schneider.
Do we have another question?
All right, we have a question stage left, all the way in the back here.
Hi, Alan. My name's Todd. If you had to define what your biggest success was, whether it was a TV or a Broadway or a movie, what would be the one thing that defines you that you are the most proud of professionally?
I don't think it would be any of those things. I think it would be really the idea that my success as an actor or, you know, in film or television or as a writer, blah, 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 the fact that that had inspired mostly young people, actually, but that my success as an artist had inspired people to come out to their parents, talk to their abusive father, you know, deal with their bullies. I can't tell you how much when people come and tell me that and say things like, you know, you inspired me to do blah. That to me is the greatest success, much more than like, you know, awards or anything like that. Really, that's, and it's not why I became an artist, obviously. I became an actor because I just liked it. But actually, I feel that I have a platform, and sometimes my platform is not just about selling the most books or the most, you know, people going to see films or winning awards. It's actually about changing people's hearts, and that's really my greatest achievement.
We have another question, stage right, towards the middle.
Hi, my name's Alan as well. We've actually met one night in a disco, but that's a whole other issue. But you introduced yourself as a writer to me, because I didn't recognize you as one of those nights. And one of the questions that I am wondering is, how do you see your role as a writer and your role as an actor, and how do you see each of those contributing what you're contributing to the world?
Oh, well, I just see it as the whole same thing, really. You know, I feel like perhaps as a writer you have more direct influence on people because like, your words are going, boom, I think this, you know. But I feel as... Oh, alarm. I feel like as an artist of any kind, I feel like I feel like I'm a provocateur. I feel like I don't want to necessarily, you know, kind of like shame you or damn you. I want to provoke you and to make you think about things. And so that's really what I think as a writer and as any form of any of the things I do. All I hope is that people will rethink their prejudices and just try and understand other people's points of view.
We have time for two more.
All right, we have a question, stage left, towards the back.
Hello. Hello. What helped you move from the violence and isolation of your childhood to become this loving, compassionate, more broad-thinking person? You must have had some support, some ideas that made you know that wasn't the only world available.
Yes, I did. I feel I had... very negative influences in my early life and very positive influences. And so, like, when you're a child and you see very disparate experiences, you grow up very quickly. Something that's not, you know, it's not so good. But you have to make a decision about what you think. And I realized, like, I always say this, my mom told me I was precious and my dad told me I was worthless. And I thought they were both wrong. And so I feel like it's a good thing for life. I feel like I sort of think, I'm somewhere in the middle. And so I think having a very damaged beginning to your life, and but coming out of it and realizing, like, whoa, that was damaged, means that you embark on your life with an understanding that is really fruitful and really remarkable, because you never take anything on face value. You always sort of think, I'll make my own opinion about this.
One more.
We have the last question, stage right, from Judy near the front.
Hi, Ellen. Did you enjoy doing Good Wife?
No.
You were kind of a nasty, sensitive politician kind of guy in an American. Did you like all that?
I loved The Good Wife. I loved it. I thought it was such a great, on many levels, you know, it was such a great thing for me to be able to be at home. You know, I live in New York. I live with my husband Grant in New York, and it was so nice to not have to travel the world all the time. And, you know, when I first started it in 2010, we'd been together 5 years, 6 years, something, and it was getting a little old, the whole kind of me traveling the world, making films, blah, blah, blah. So suddenly this idea that 9 months of the year I'd be in New York was really good. And also it made me realize about the value of writing, and that if you are on a TV show or wherever you're in, if you have great writing, it can sustain you for much, much longer than you ever thought it was possible, because clever, clever people engender great things in other people. And so the standard of writing in that show really changed my life. And I would never have thought I was going to be on a TV show for 7 seasons. I mean, come on. But I did, and I never felt bored. I did sometimes feel bored, that's not true. But I really felt like I had this great base and these great people, and I just had a great time. And what was your question? I enjoyed it very much, and I actually, as much as I didn't enjoy all the aspects of the finale, like I really wanted Eli to take revenge on Peter. But you know what? The show is called The Good Wife, not The Good Eli, and so the biggest story was this kind of arc of a thing she did, this violence she did on someone else at the beginning, and then this violence being done on her because of her actions. I thought that was amazing. And there's a new whole spin-off.
Yeah. I'm gonna tell them.
Do you know? Come on, people. Oh, so on CBS All Access, it's some like, you know, Netflix version of CBS, they're doing this version of The Good Wife, not a version, but a spin-off of The Good Wife with Christine, you know, Bransky, and Kush Jumbo, who played Luca, and my daughter, Sarah. I love... I never thought I'd say my daughter and be like, would be. So anyway, they're doing a new thing on this kind of launching this channel of internet beauty.
Great.
Whatever.
We have one more question that's a tradition. I'm just doing what this woman is telling me to do.
She's crazy, isn't she? That one, yeah.
I know.
This is number minutes.
It started in the green room, and it's just gone downhill since.
I got some vegan chicken out of it. Yeah.
I get to do a plug for my own book now, which is called When We Rise, and it will be published by Hachette Book Group. It comes out November 29th. I'm very excited about it. And the ABC miniseries that is partly inspired by it has been filmed and is going to air probably the second week of February, directed part of it by Gus Van Sant, also Dustin Lance Black, a lot of the people that made the film Milk here in San Francisco. So buy my book and come to my party. I'm having a party across the street at Strut on Saturday, the 3rd of December. So please stop by. And now it is an in-forum tradition to ask all our speakers the following question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
That's me.
Yes.
First of all, I think it's really important to have more women do more things in the world. Stop talking because my 60 seconds. But really, like I know Hillary Clinton's the candidate, but that's not enough. Like, women are not represented enough in the world. They're more than our 50% of population. They're not represented. That's one thing.
I think you only get one.
I know. I get 60 seconds.
60 seconds
they
is up.
They clap for a lot, Cleve.
She says we're done.
What's it? I can do more, can't I? I can do more. 10 seconds. Okay, so the other thing is that I exhort all of you, to understand the importance of why Donald Trump should not become president. Don't clap right now. Don't clap. Don't clap. It's much more important than that. Donald Trump must not become president of this country because this is a man with no ideas and no policies. It's about ego and maniacal things. This is fascism at work. Don't clap. And we have a great responsibility to make sure that he does not become president by talking to people that we don't normally talk to. And like writing emails to people we don't know, but it's getting scary now. And our country, which we think of, we've had a black president, we've had blah 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 blah, we could easily spiral downwards into the worst of humanity because the things that he is espousing are the worst of humanity. Absolutely. So now you can clap.
Yes. Thank you, Alan Cumming. So buy his book.
Buy my book.
Line up, and he's going to sign them.
I'm going to sign them.
And let's give him another round of applause. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Cleve. That's so nice.